And
call to order this meeting of the House Rules Committee. It's Thursday, May 26th, 2011. I think we are, well, we've got the last two bills on our agenda we're going to deal with when those members arrive, which I expect will be soon, and the rest will just take them up in order. So let's begin by opening a work session on House Bill 2256.
Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 2256. You first heard this in February. Let me tell you what it does. It authorizes complaints regarding alleged violations of election law to be filed electronically. It deletes requirements that unused ballots be destroyed after an election. It limits signature gathering period to 2 years for a petition to initiate district measures, deleting the notice requirement for signature gathering that exceeds 1 year. It specifies notice and filing requirements for district elections and places responsibility on district election authorities. It does a number of election cleanup things. You have the -1 amendment that you've seen before that deletes provisions removing the county judge candidacy filing to the county clerks. In other words, the county judges would continue to file their candidacy with Secretary of State. And you have the -2 amendment, which appeared yesterday, which is clarifies language governing the nominations and election for nonpartisan offices. It requires that explicit procedures for securing unused ballots be included in county election security plans. It authorizes the county clerks to publish notices of election and ballot titles electronically. And probably not the least important, it repeals provisions for elections to determine whether dogs may run at large. It also makes other technical changes to Oregon's election law. We request the fiscal on this morning, so we don't have the fiscal on this -2 yet.
So we're not going to be moving this bill today because of the fiscal Mr. Stenberg just mentioned, but I thought it'd be helpful if Steve comes up and gives us his counsel, especially based on this lengthy -2 we just received. Steve, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. Steve Trout, State Election Director, and thanks for the opportunity to give a little bit of background and clarification on the -2 amendments, which we have put forward. The -2s represent issues that we have identified going through the November election cycle and others that that popped up subsequent to us submitting this bill before the November election, and so it's continuing with cleaning up language to help with election administration. And so I'll just go through the highlights, and if you have any more detailed questions, we can dive in deeper there. The first one is in changing 247.012 sub 5, deleting within the same county for voter registration forms. With the change from HAVA and the implementation of OCVR, Statewide Voter Registration Database, the state became the official repository of all voter registration forms. Previously, that responsibility was with the counties. And so as a result of that change in process and federal law, voter registration cards now can, any move within the state is an update to a registration. And so this just reflects that a move from one county within Oregon to another county within Oregon is an update, and so it adds that clarification. Also, in deleting sentence 2 of 253.065, current law requires the name of the county clerk to be printed on ballot envelopes that are mailed out to voters. In some of our counties, the county clerk is not the election official. We have some appointed election officials with their name, and then also this there's been concern that it's not appropriate to have the name of the county clerk on the envelope if their name was on the ballot, and that was actually raised by some of the county clerks and thought that was a good idea to eliminate that requirement. There's part of this -2 amendment also will allow county clerks to publish their notices online. It does not remove the requirement to to provide those in print, but it gives them the opportunity to provide that online to provide more notice to more people. So there are a number of sections of the bill that are just that allows the filing of notices online. And then the amendments regarding ORS 249.088 and 091, we talked about this at length back in February, and really this is an attempt to clarify language. We're not trying to change the law at all here, just to make it more clear so that counties and candidates know who's going to appear on what ballot. And as we discussed last time, I'm not able to get it as clear as I would like because there's a constitutional provision involved that says that in some of these elections, the election has to be, the winner has to be declared at the general election, which would mean November. And so we've got statutes and so we've attempted here to make it as clear as possible so that we won't have situations where the wrong people end up on the May ballot when they shouldn't appear on the ballot until November. And then the one that always gets a good laugh with the elections for relating to dogs running wild. This is strictly a cleanup of some very old statutes. Apparently, the current law in Section 609 says that with 100 signatures, a special election could be ordered relative to the dogs running at wild, and that would be impossible to administer in conjunction with all of the other election rules and statutes that we have in the 246 to 260 section. It was identified by one of the counties as something that should have been deleted years ago, and so we bring that to you, and hopefully you won't have any more detailed questions on that because it sounds funny.
Actually,
President Barnard, do we have any precincts with dog control programs?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I honestly do not know. I know that there's three or four counties that approached us about changing this and the need for it.
Well, the reason I ask, Mr. Chair, is that the amendment does say that they can continue to enforce those programs. I just wondered if there were any. But it certainly won't keep me from voting for the amendment.
Further questions for Steve? Representative Berger.
The dogs running wild thing, in the dash, it's still there in the dash two, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, my understanding is that the dash twos changed part of it, and I was just talking to Ledge Council about this as we came in. Some parts were able to be changed in this bill because of the relating clause, and some are not.
Okay, so there's still dogs in this bill. There's still a dog here, or two. I'm getting nods behind you. Okay. And that's because of relating clause.
Gina, do you want to comment on? The dogs.
An interesting curiosity.
I know, Mr. Chair, this has something to do with Bob Dylan's birthday, and if dogs could run free, why can't we?
I'm sorry I asked, Mr. Chair. I would draw
Gina
the question.
Gina Zedlick from Legislative Council, co-chair, Representative Berger. The piece that's in the dash two repeals the old language in statute regarding dogs running at large, which sounds like they can run for an office, but they
I love the Rules Committee.
Hey, we have that on recording, though. Yeah.
Sunny Die.
Sunny Die takes it.
Ow.
So all the dash twos do is remove the ability for someone to file a petition with 100 signatures calling for an election to prohibit that. So people can still file a petition, they just have to follow the normal rules of asking for an election and filing a petition.
Okay.
That's all.
Any questions about any non-dog related items?
Is it fair to say that the dash twos, you mentioned some concerns that you were incorporating from the county clerks. This, the dash twos are supported by both the elections division and the county clerks. Is that fair to say?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay. Thank you both. We'll await the fiscals. Yeah.
Oh,
Representative Barner.
This may have already been answered, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
The twos include the ones, or are they separate, or do we know?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the dash ones and the dash two are separate.
Okay.
Not mutually exclusive, not in conflict, just separate areas of focus. The dash ones just deal with removing sections related to county judge
filing.
Filing, yes.
I see. Thank you.
Which aren't referenced, I don't think, at all in the dash twos, right, Steve?
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Holby.
Well, now that you've brought that up, do the county clerks and the elections division have an opinion on the dash ones?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holby, you know, we would prefer that the judges go back to filing with the counties as they did, which was originally in our bill. But we're not going to go to the death to preserve that. We're happy to continue to accept the filings for those 13 judges at the state level, and the fiscal impact of that would be minimal.
What will you go to the death to preserve?
Freedom.
No need.
It was a rhetorical
just
question.
Just giving you a hard time. Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thanks.
And this is a work session, so we don't have anyone else signed up on this. So we will, Representative Barner, go ahead.
Just quickly, while they're still here, I think what the dash one does is repeal section one and, or take section one and two out of the bill. Does it do anything else other than renumbering? Thank you. That helps.
Okay. Close the work session on House Bill 2256, awaiting the fiscal. And we are still awaiting one sponsor on that, so let's jump down to the bottom. Make sense to you?
You want to do these instead?
We've got Representative Matthews here for 3668, and we're awaiting Representative Hoyle to join Representative Johnson and Representative Clemmer here, but we're waiting for the third part of that. So let's go down and open a public hearing on House Bill 3668 for Representative Matthews. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, House Bill 3668 requires the Commission of Labor to notify the Director of Veterans Affairs when information or complaint is filed regarding alleged violation of employment rights of militia members or discrimination against members of the informed military, if that message is authorized by the member.
Welcome from the amazing community of Gresham to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Chair Hunt. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Matthews, State Representative, House District 50, the incredible city of Gresham, which I think is now on the record. Pleased and proud to be here before you today to testify in favor of a House Bill 3668. And, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you would find it appropriate at this time or not, but Jim Willis, I believe, with DVA, would like to testify as well as Kate Newhall. Is that possible? They join
yes,
me?
Yes, you bet.
Thank you. Briefly, House Bill 3668 is kind of it creates a catch basin, if you will, for veterans that are seeking remedy. And what this does, and by the way, we have consensus. I've met with Commissioner Brad Avakian, but Kate has done a lot of the work on it. And what this does is when a veteran feels as if there's a violation of ORS 659A082 or 659A086, they would notify BOLI, and then BOLI would then, within 30 days, notify the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. This is important because these veterans are trying to gain access to their benefits and access to their rights, and it's just one more situation where we're able to have perhaps a second set of eyes, but also follow up with BOLI so that we can make sure our veterans are being treated fairly, but beyond that, getting the proper benefits. And I think it's a great compromise on a bill that we had prior to this. I think that we have found that this is a great solution. There is a problem that does exist, and this solves that problem. So with that being said, Mr. Chair, I appreciate you moving this bill forward today, and thank you so much. And I'll turn it over to two folks that came to agreement with us to make this happen.
Great. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Hunt, members of the committee, for the record, Kate Newhall with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. As you all know, we are the agency responsible for the enforcement of the state's employment protections for our uniformed servicemen and women and our veterans preference hiring laws. As such, we fully support House Bill 3668. And as Representative Matthews related, we did work together in the drafting of this concept, and we do support the referral process that it implements so that when we have any complaints filed by members of the uniformed service or veterans, we will, with their consent, refer those complaints over to the Department of Veterans Affairs so that they can follow up with them and assess if there are any services or benefits that might be available to that veteran that they may not have been aware of, and do whatever they can to get all of those available resources provided to them. One thing that I would note that's kind of neat about this legislation is that it will go beyond just the people filing complaints alleging discrimination based on their uniformed service or their veterans hiring preference, and it will also include people who may be service people or veterans who are filing complaints with us of something like racial discrimination, a whistleblower complaint, or any other of the complaints filed under 659A. So we would capture not only the folks that are just filing complaints with us based on the employment discriminations for their uniform service, but also all sorts of civil rights complaints that may come in through our doors filed by veterans. We did work closely with the Department of Veterans Affairs in devising this legislation. We look forward to the partnership and the coordination that it will bring. And actually, just on a closing, I think it has been a good process in terms of getting those communications sort of open and ready to go, and I think will result in better and more effective services by both of our agencies to veterans in Oregon. Thank you.
Great. Welcome. It was nice to have your stand-in here last week, but we always appreciate you here in person.
Thank you, Chair Hunt, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Willis, excuse me, the Director of Veterans Affairs for the State of Oregon. You have my written testimony, so I'm only going to do two paragraphs to demonstrate the real world of why this partnership is so important. It started with a case occurring in Woodburn, Oregon, where a veteran came home, did not get his job back, but was immediately demoted and then fired. The veteran contacted the Department of Labor in Boley. However, ODVA learned about the situation only after reading it in the newspaper. At that time, Boley and ODVA did not have the agreement that's outlined in House Bill 3668. When we contacted the veteran, we immediately began providing added support to him and his family. He needed a disability claim to be done, and we did that. He also needed to be enrolled in VA health care. He also needed to receive an emergency grant so that he could fix his vehicle, attend his medical appointments, and his job interviews. And then further, we put the family in touch with other state and local resources to help them through this very difficult time until later he was actually able to gain employment. Had we been notified, as this partnership will do for the future, should this bill pass, we could have acted much quicker and been able to aid this veteran faster. And in the future, when Boley notifies us about a veteran that contacts them with a labor claim or, as Kate just said, a whistleblower issue or any other that's under their statutory responsibility, we can do outreach to the veteran immediately, or almost as a referral directly from Boley over to our office. They're just down the street from where our office is. And I think we're just going to do a far better job of aiding the veterans within our mission. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I thank you for the time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions, colleagues?
Mr. Chair.
Charles.
Thank you. Jim, I don't know if you're aware of an incident that occurred in Sherwood a couple years back, and I'm not familiar with this one in Woodburn, but there was kind of a similar situation that occurred up there in Sherwood, too. So would this apply to that type, that situation, too?
Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, Co-Chair Olson, yes, it would apply. However, in that particular case, that individual chose to take their case to the federal, under federal USERRA, but it could have been brought to Boley. They could have also acted because the elements that are necessary to adjudicate the case could have been acted upon either at the state or federal level. That one just happened to be done at the federal level.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anything in statute now that prevents you from writing or from reaching an agreement with Boley about this kind of issue without this bill? I'm planning to vote for the bill, but I'm wondering why I can't just write an agreement with them that does the same thing.
Well,
or do we have some kind of restrictions around the confidentiality or some such?
Well, Chair, I was just going to say, yes, Chair Hunt and members of the committee, unfortunately, sometimes with regard to the personnel issues involving the veteran, if we don't have access to those with the permission of the veteran through an agreement like this, an intergovernmental, a statutory agreement, it makes it sometimes harder for us to get the personnel information. This makes it much easier.
A quick follow-up. Mr.
Barnhart?
You indicated a federal agency that works with the same kinds of things. Do you have arrangements with them to deal with the same kind of issue when they receive a complaint?
Yes, Representative Hunt and Representative Barnhart, yes, we do.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for our witnesses? We really appreciate. Oh, Representative Matthews.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that these two individuals with me today are representative of a couple agencies, really, that I think are just doing stellar work for our veterans. And I think the legislative body gets a tremendous amount of credit for what we do because we're out in the eyes of the public in terms of votes. But quite honestly, what the director has done, and Kate specifically, and Commissioner Vakian, they have seen the need to take care of our citizen soldiers. They're doing it on a daily basis. They're committed to finding ways of working together, and I think this represents just one of those. So I appreciate you moving this forward, and I would appreciate it moving out, but again, I really appreciate moving to the front today. Thank you.
We appreciate all the work that all three of you put into resuscitating this bill. Maybe could the three of you next take on another good bill that died in that committee related to naming a certain armory after a former governor? Maybe the three of you can work together.
Mr. Chair, currently that's locked up with another bill to do with running dogs. We're working on it.
I'm sure the McCall family will be pleased. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you all. We don't have anyone signed up. Does anyone else want to testify on House Bill 3668? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on 3668. Look forward to having that back for a work session. And let's move up to opening a public hearing on House Bill 3670. Right forward. Why don't we have all three of Representative Johnson, get the staff from Representative Coyle's office. And Representative Clem, you can come to the next panel or this one, whatever your preference is. Okay, fair enough.
Don't have the
people
yet.
Mr.
Sambridge. Mr. Chairman, we have Anna Teske is going to provide staff on this measure.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3670 establishes the for-profit independent college student association account, assistance account with the Oregon Student Assistance Fund. It allows the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to award monies in the account to the Oregon Opportunity Grant to students accepted into eligible for-profit post-secondary institutions. It authorizes OSAC to accept funds for the account from public and private sources and defines eligible schools as a school approved to offer and confer degrees and is certified by the Office of Degree Authorization as an Oregon-based for-profit independent institution. The fiscal impact statement on this particular bill came back as an indeterminate, citing that the measure identifies possible funding sources, but the amount of funds available for the grant from the account is currently unknown. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Welcome, gentlemen. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mark Johnson, State Representative for House District 52. For this part of the session, I've had the privilege of being a part of the Higher Ed Subcommittee, and in that time as a member of that committee, it's become apparent to me that there are some wonderful things going on with our higher ed system in this state. And there are some challenges as well. One of the things that's apparent about the current state of affairs within our higher ed system is that enrollment is up dramatically across the board. If you're talking about OUS institutions or community colleges, enrollment is up significantly over the past decade. And that can be a good thing, but it can also be a thing that can create some need for some intervention. And one of the points that has become abundantly clear to me and I think the other members of our subcommittee is that there's a greater even greater role being played in our higher ed system by independent career colleges. They're playing an expanded role out of necessity for the most part because our existing higher ed system of community colleges and to some extent our university system just plain do not have enough space, they do not have enough career program offerings to satisfy the demand of students who are looking for accreditation or job training programs that can enable them to become career ready. Some of these career colleges are, in fact, offering programs now that are directly connected to private sector industries. I would just mention a few. Intel, I know, is one corporation that has a direct connection with the career college. There are other private sector partnerships where students who are able to become accredited, obtain career degrees, they have a direct segue into the job market in Oregon. And I know there are folks here today that will be able to speak to that. But in these difficult times, access to these programs can become difficult, and in fact can be very difficult for students. At this point, career college students do not have access to the Oregon Opportunity Grant as other public sector students do. That grant could, in fact, having access to this sort of grant could help them to be able to afford the cost of their education, which could in turn enable more and more students to participate in our higher ed system. House Bill 3670 is an attempt to address that problem. It allows for the creation of a privately funded account that would then in turn be administered by OSAC under all the same rules of eligibility and need-based scholarships that OSAC currently extends to students within the system. In short, this bill is about increasing access to higher ed, and in turn will increase Oregon's supply of career-ready graduates who are ready to enter our workforce. In short, this is a bipartisan effort. Rep. Hoyle and I have worked hard to bring this bill to you today. This is about pro-higher education in Oregon. It's about being pro-job creation, and I appreciate the time to have this time before you today. And with that, I will turn it over to not Rep. Hoyle, but Rep. Hoyle's assistant, who will add a few words for this, too.
Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, member of the committee. My name is Matt Davis. I'm legislative aide to Representative Val Hoyle, and I will be speaking on her behalf today. Thank you for the time. Representative Hoyle believes that it's vital for Oregonians to have as many opportunities as possible to be trained and educated to enter the workforce. Independent colleges are an avenue for Oregonians to gain additional training and education. In difficult economic times, we've seen many Oregon residents looking for ways to learn trades or retrain to find jobs. Some of these independent institutions provide the best pathway to achieving career goals of Oregonians. Allowing opportunity grants to be awarded to these students recognizes that these independent colleges contribute to a more educated workforce. This has been a piece of bipartisan legislation, and Representative Hoyle urges your support. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Questions, colleagues?
Representative Hoyle.
Now you're in the same district.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm struggling a little bit with this bill, and I'm just sort of curious. We have a for-profit school model, and you're asking that OSAC, which is generally deals with opportunity grants for public education institutions, to manage an account. I'm wondering why can't the for-profit schools have set up their own account, manage it themselves to provide grants to students who attend those for-profit institutions instead of mixing this with the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program?
Chair Hunt, Rep. Polvey, I appreciate the question, and I'm sure there's folks behind me that can probably address that more fully, but I would just say I think it standardizes the entrance into the higher ed system a little bit more. It elevates the career colleges to a point that I think gives them a little more credibility, because I really do think they're doing a fine job of meeting a need in our higher ed system. There are systems in place already within OSAC in terms of determining need and so forth, and it just would enable these students to be considered on the same footing, if you will, of other students that are seeking those Oregon Opportunity Grants as the system currently exists. So there are tracks to run on within the program, I think, now, and I don't think that it would be my personal feeling. I think you'll hear from some folks behind me that I don't think it's going to add a further burden upon OSAC to be able to administer these privately funded grants. So that would be my answer, but there might be some folks behind me that could have a better answer for that question.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you both.
Appreciate
the information. Bring the bill forward. Let's we have Representative Clem here, so let's go ahead and take Representative Clem, and then we'll return to the other four folks who signed up to testify. Welcome to the Rules Committee. No references to dogs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brian Clem. I'm a state representative from District 21 here in Salem. I also served 6 years on the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, four of those as the chair. And this issue, two issues in this bill. One, I think I can be of some help on, and I think it's a good idea. The other one, I have very strong opposition to, which I'll explain. The creating of the fund for private awards, I think, is a good idea, but it can already be done, and I actually took the liberty of starting the fund myself today down at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. I've attached the paperwork for any of you who are interested in either having a fund like it or contributing to it. And it's just a two-page form to create this fund. It's the exact same, dollars will go to the exact same place the bill would go to, and I even named it the same thing that the bill has, the For-Profit Independent Colleges Student Assistance Fund. And I've got you all copies of it if you want to contribute to it. So let me talk about the part I don't like. And the reason I don't like it is after hours and hours and hours of testimony and reading about this issue when I was the chair, we had a pretty in-depth set of hearings on this issue and explicitly rejected this policy at the Student Assistance Commission. And that's happened a number of times throughout the Student Assistance Commission. It's been requested to do this quite a few times, always rejected. So this would definitely supersede and override the decision of past commissions, which that's the legislature's prerogative. There's no, you know, it's not, you can't do that, but this has been looked at and thought about by people who this is all they do. So let me tell you why at that time we rejected it and what persuaded me. The for-profit career school, you know, has, I think, its good actors and its bad actors. Some of you will know some of the bad actors from headline news, like BCTI, who the feds had to raid here in Salem in my district for a variety of unfair and illegal practices by that institution to just simply enroll people in order to gain access to financial aid, but not really educate them. And I mean, I have 15 pages of them. I won't go through them all for you today. But it's not just one, and it's not just in other places. The Technical Career Institute was found to have improperly paid $500,000 to lenders to reduce the default cohort rate artificially in order to get access to the student loan program. The National School of Technology in Miami and two campuses of the Florida Center were raided also by federal officials for illegal activities related to their default rate and falsifying of documents. Another group that you'll know, University of Phoenix, their parent company, the Apollo Group, has settled a number of times with both their shareholders and students. One of the shareholder settlements was $233 million settlement for falsely reporting data associated with their student recruitment tactics and saying that they didn't employ people to recruit people based just on their the ability to gain compensation by recruiting people and being paid just on how many people they could recruit, regardless of their eligibility or the likelihood of success at their school. So they were, they've been in trouble a number of times for not following the law around trying to get people into their school who really are going to be helped, and instead looking more at the bonuses they would receive. These are the recruiters themselves that are not alleged. They in some cases were found by OIG audits. Other times they just settled with their shareholders. So you've got some institutes who I'm sure operate fine. They have a business without the opportunity grant as part of their base for funding or the revenue stream. But the Federal Department of Education has found that there has been a an effort by some in this world to just create a business model out of using federal student aid when otherwise their business would fail. And I'm a business owner of three businesses, and I don't in any of my businesses use any kind of government student aid programs or grants, so I can't personally talk about that. But when free market is working well, like it has been in Oregon, these quality career schools thrive and do well, and the ones that are sort of the scam artists only here to get access to the federal financial aid program get raided by the feds and go away. So I think you'll hear from some that are the quality, reputable ones, but the ones that have come in years past were an embarrassment to the name of an educational institution and the kind of crimes they committed against their students. So this is why the Student Assistance Commission over the years has rejected allowing career schools in, because we couldn't seem to find a set of criteria or parameters that would make folks in the financial aid and higher ed world feel comfortable that there wasn't going to be abuse and tax dollars going to schools who were just using the system to keep their businesses afloat. In the Sacramento area, there was a couple of studies done, and the rate of people at local for-profit students taking out federal loans was about 56%. At the local community college, only 3% took out loans. And so, you know, I think the part of the question is, are there options for students to go to now where they can get access to the Oregon Opportunity Grant and federal aid programs, or do we need to thin the soup of current opportunity eligible or of the Oregon Opportunity Grant by adding in a new pool of people? This would add in a whole lot more people to the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which is already underfunded. And so then you need to look at the success rate of these places compared to local private nonprofits like Willamette Pacific or Chemeketa or George Fox. All of those students are eligible for the Opportunity Grant, and someone would have to lose theirs in order for one of these to benefit. So, you know, I'm in favor of supporting Oregon institutions. Some of these for-profits may very well be Oregon institutions, but many of them are not Oregon headquartered and centered institutions. So I won't go on ad nauseum, but I have 15 pages of documentation from lots of different players in this world who have been either found guilty, settled, or accused of manipulating the incentive systems, grade inflation, in order to get access to federal financial aid. And that's why we've chosen all these years to not have them have access to Oregon taxpayer dollars, because we just couldn't come up with something that made us feel comfortable. So I would encourage the legislature to reject the portion that would override the past policy decision by the Student Assistance Commission, and encourage people to support the fund that I have offered you a way to contribute to it today if you like to. I'm sure Susan Deegan could take the check. I just got to get it set up and send my check as well. And with that, I would take any questions.
Questions for Representative Clem. Representative Weir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clem, do you have any sense of what percentage the horror stories make up of the overall group of private providers? Because I think, we could talk about Willamette ESD or certain public institutions that also don't necessarily perform well or attract a lot of negative attention for some. And I'm trying to get a context here on the overall universe of these providers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to find one quote that came from that was about the overall around the I'm just going to find a second. One example in New York, and this isn't just about financial aid, this is about for-profit college activities. The legislature put a moratorium on establishment of any new programs by for-profit colleges, period. Not just access to financial aid, any, because there was so much fraud and abuse. They then approved new regulations on for-profit institutions, including a transition period that I think helped weed out the good from the bad. But the problem got so pervasive in New York that they stopped both the good and the bad from creating new programs at one time. The other one I'm looking for is a federal study that was done nationwide, and I can't find it because I thought I highlighted them all. And he talked about the business model, basically, the business model being set up pretty commonly, not just a rare exception, but fairly commonly to, you know, get a limited number of a limited number of programs, mostly qualified teachers, and then the whole business was about recruiting. Just get them in the door, recruit, and it didn't seem to be about the education system. And it's, I can provide it to you later, but I thought I'd highlight it. There was a federal official who was in studying their different the different things around the country, said they thought it was fairly pervasive in the industry, period. And I'll find it for you just so you've got what I'm talking about. But he used the term recruit like hell, and I just can't quite find the hell in my deal, but it's in here somewhere.
Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the bill, and you were on the commission for some time, and now I've managed to misplace here it is, the part I was looking at. On page 3, and the top of page 4, section 5, we see sub 1, new sub A, the account that we currently have. And in that language, it says that the fund is for investment and for the payment of the expenses of the Student Assistance Commission in carrying out its purposes and lists a bunch of things. The new language, sub B, talks about money that is to be used for continuously appropriated and shall be used to award Oregon opportunity grants under ORS 348-260 to students accepted into eligible schools as defined in section 6. And then it talks about accepting funds from any source and so forth. It appears to me as though, and maybe this is a question for Jim rather than you, I don't know, but it appears to omit the payment of expenses from the new sub B, that all that money would go toward awards of grants. Have I read that language correctly?
She's going to look up the statute. I don't know if Representative Clem, you have a comment on that, or we can come back to that.
Well, I may be asking the wrong person.
Yeah, well, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually, in reading what you're talking about, I think it does say that all monies in the account are appropriated to them and shall be used to award grants. It doesn't say anything about allowing for administrative overhead. I'm arguing myself that you don't need that portion of the bill anyway,
right,
because you can already create account in the same
right
fund the bill calls for with the document that I've set out in front of you. And that interest earned by the donor's private money to that account, I'll make sure Susan is nodding, would stay with the account anyway. Yeah. And but the OSAC is allowed to take some sort of administrative fund for their effort.
Well,
so if you use the fund, it would be superior to the provisions of the bill.
Representative Warner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed on the accompanying document I'm not sure what it's called, but anyway, it's the document that came with the form that you sent. You note toward the bottom of that, it says that OSAC assesses a scholarship support service surcharge to support scholarship processing and disbursement, which I assume is what we're talking about. And if I read the bill correctly, they wouldn't be able to charge that surcharge to this new account under this proposed bill.
So I think Anna is looking up the statutory reference, so she can get back to us in a few minutes with a more definitive answer to that question, perhaps. Representative Holby?
Thank you, Representative Clem. Appreciate you coming forward based on your past experience with this. I know you were talking a little bit, and Representative Wingard sort of touched on the question about the performance of these schools. And I had read somewhere that the for-profit schools make up about 12% of the undergraduate population, and 30% of all student loan borrowers, but the students at the for-profits also make up 50% of the student nationwide default, or students that default on their loans. And I'm wondering if that's indicative of the comments that you were making about, you know, how it'd be best to invest or use this program for
public schools or the ones that are currently. It just seems like we're short of money in these programs. We'd be better to use it in an area that, that doesn't have such a high default. And why do they have such high defaults? Is it because they're just bringing more and more students in and trying to gain more profit? And I have a second part of that question is, are these for-profit schools, are they registered with the state somehow and upheld to some sort of standards for curriculum and criteria? Because I'm just unaware of that.
Thank you. Let me take the second part first. The bill actually, I think, even speaks to that the entity needed to have received approval to offer and confer degrees by the Office of Degree Authorization. So in this case, they would. And there are entities who are allowed to operate on a, in an unaccredited basis. That is allowed. That does exist even. There are students who have degrees from those schools. For example, Oral Roberts University didn't used to want to seek accreditation for philosophical reasons. They actually did eventually go seek it. So there are unaccredited schools that exist. That there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with them. They had reasons for not wanting to do it. In this bill, they would need to in order to access this fund. Generally speaking, most choose to get accredited, I think. Most of the ones you would know of certainly do. But there are some reasons someone would be unaccredited. There also are what we would call diploma mills, and we've gone after those in Oregon, no matter where they're at, really in a way that gained us national prestige and reputation for protecting the validity of our degrees. Alan Contreras, who is the Office of Degree Authorization Administrator for many years now, is a nationally known expert on protecting the value of degrees by making sure these programs really are reviewed and they're really offering real education. So if they're certified by OSAC as legit, I have complete confidence they're legit. And as I said, there are some who have good reasons to not get accredited. And then there are some who are purely located in the Isle of St. Kitts, and you can buy your internet degree in 15 minutes for a couple $1,000 and claim you're a PhD or able to do, you know, a wedding tomorrow if you want to. That's kind of the range of it. The first part, and this is, again, I don't want to disparage the educational quality of career schools generally by any means, but it's the incentive for getting students into the schools was the nut we couldn't figure out how to crack. I mean, another example was a recruiter at, this ABC News did a big report on this, a recruiter at Remington College told an undercover producer posing a potential student that despite his felony conviction, a variety of jobs in criminal justice would be open to him, including positions as sheriff, corrections officer, jailer, and border patrol officer, when in fact felony convictions in Texas prohibit you from doing those things. But the guy made the money by telling him that to get him to sign the paper, and then he walked on to the next one. And at a local admissions office or recruitment office at Willamette or at Chemeketa, they're not paid that way. They're not. It's not set up in the same way for them to push so hard. There's another one about an Iraq war veteran who was promised they would get accommodation for their PTSD and traumatic brain injury if they would just sign this paper and come to our school, and then they got none of it. And the person, you know, struggled, took out a bunch of student loans, went bankrupt. And so that's the part we could never figure out how to, maybe someone else has a good idea, but it would require amending it, obviously, how to put sideboards around it to make sure that the incentive practices for getting people to sign up for the school guarantee it's about the student's educational success and not the for-profit business model of that particular company trying to just make sure they had volume running through there. Like in my business, I want to sell pears on a volume basis, and I try and keep quality up, but I'm not getting government money to keep my pears up. We don't get a subsidy, so I have to really do it based on whether someone will buy my pears, not whether I just happen to, you know, have price supports the way other parts of ag does. So I'm more of a free market guy.
We've got four other folks signed up to testify.
They go on for hours. Out of here.
Can we move on? All right. Thank you, Representative Clem. Appreciate it. Invite up Linda Rees and Dan Jarman. And a friend. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Linda Ruiz, and I am currently a student at ITT Technical Institute, Portland campus, studying electronics technology. While I am not a native Oregonian, I have lived here for the past 10 years and have decided to make Oregon my permanent home. From an early age, I've always been interested in electronics, how things work and what makes them tick, so to speak. So upon graduation in 1982, I enrolled at ITT Technical Institute in the West Covina campus down in Southern California. Luckily, I was able to qualify for a Pell Grant, and along with the federal Title IV funding and Pell Grants, it was able to cover 100% of my two-year associate's degree education at ITT Tech. Unfortunately, in February of 2004, I was forced to drop out of school because of the death of my father and some other personal circumstances, so I was never able to finish my education. Since then, I have fallen into the legal field. I spent 22 years in the legal field working as a legal assistant, and I did so well, I decided just to make that my career path choice, and was very happy doing so until February of 2009 when I was laid off from Stoll Reeves, which is Oregon's largest law firm. It was quite a shock to me and to the 25 other legal assistants that were laid off at the same time. For the first 9 months, I did try to find work, but the market was so saturated with so many other people being out of work in my field, I realized I was facing a very difficult battle and decided I needed to reinvent myself. So then I remembered the ITT Technical Institute education I had started all those years ago. So I called the Portland campus, made an appointment to sit down with the chair of the electronics program and the registrar to see what, if any, of the credits I had earned prior would be transferable now. They were very gracious in working with me and helping me to get some of the credits transferred over. They were instrumental in helping me to obtain Pell Grant funding, but unfortunately, because it was a for-profit school, I was denied the opportunity to apply for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which has left quite a gap in the funding compared to what I received in California. The Cal Grant in California is basically the same as the Oregon Opportunity Grant here. I will be graduating in 2 weeks from ITT Tech, and I'm very excited about what I've been able to accomplish during this difficult economic time. I've taken a bad situation and turned it around. However, being eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant would have made things a lot easier for me because now I am faced with student loans to pay back the portion that could have been covered by the grant. I'm very excited to be re-entering the workforce and once again becoming contributing member of society, and I'm proud to be an Oregon resident. And as a student here in Oregon, I feel that the Oregon Opportunity Grant should be available across the board to any student who wishes to use it in the way that they choose. Another side note I'd like to include is I have been receiving unemployment insurance the entire time I've been going to school at ITT Tech. Now, the state of Oregon Unemployment Department recognizes ITT Tech as a reputable institution, and actually I had to receive approval from the state of Oregon to continue receiving those unemployment benefits. So it would just make sense that if one arm of the Oregon government recognizes ITT Tech as a reputable institution, that I would hope another arm of the government would recognize it as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Makes sense.
Dan, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman representing the Northwest Career College Federation. We're here to ask that you support and move House Bill 3670 to the floor. It's always important to keep the focus on the students when you're looking at legislation such as this. What we try to do with this is, and this is a variation of a piece of legislation that was in the higher ed subcommittee and didn't make its way out for various reasons, but it's been amended, we think, in a way to address some of the concerns that we've heard from members, including Representative Clem, who spoke earlier. And so let me talk a little bit about what the bill actually does. We set up a separate account within the Oregon Opportunity Grant that would be specific and discreet for those students who are attending accredited degree-granting for-profit career colleges. Now, Representative Clem, for instance, mentioned we've never been able to figure out the criteria and the parameters to kind of identify the good programs and the programs that aren't so good. We think this is the way to do it. Oregon, as you all know, has one of the best programs in the state for managing and overseeing degree programs. And Mr. Representative Clem mentioned the fine work of Alan Contreras, and we would agree with that. The students who would be able to access this discrete account would have to be in a program that's accredited and a degree-granting program. And we think those are the correct parameters to allow these students to access the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Now, There is not competition, as to address the question from Representative Holvey about competition with other students, because this particular account is would be for those students who are in these programs and only these programs. But what we would do is we would allow contributions to come from outside of the state to populate this account. Contributions from the career colleges themselves, from foundations, they have alumni associations, or even individuals who would want to see the state sort of public-private partnership in looking at need-based grants for students in these programs. Representative Clem raises an issue, why don't we just set up something separate? Well, we want to perhaps allow future legislators, if they choose, to put state monies into this account. There's nothing in this bill that prevents, that requires this legislature or future legislators from putting any state money into this account. Let me be very clear about this. But it does give the option to do that in the future. And we certainly hope that we can do our job in convincing policymakers here in the state that the career colleges that are operating in Oregon are very above board. We're the first to admit that there are bad players, and the examples that Representative Clem cited are happening in other states. The Northwest Career College Federation presidents have made some very strong comments that those practices are just unacceptable and in some ways criminal, and they should be held accountable. But if you go and you visit one of these career schools that is trying to do the job of other institutions to meet the 40-40-20 objectives of the state, I think you'll find that they're doing exceptional work. And under the oversight of ODA, I think these are very strong programs. That's one of the reasons why I think Representative Hoyle and some of the members who are sponsors of the bill, including Conger, Demereaux, Comp, Lindsay, Springer, Senator Haas, Senator Monroe, have been supportive of this. Many of those members have gone to these schools, have talked to the students, talked to the faculty, and know that they're adding something positive to the educational structure of the state. So thank you for your time. We're certainly happy to answer any questions. Wayne Madlich, who's the president of ITT here in Portland and the president of the Northwest Career College Federation, to answer any questions that you may have. And thank you for your time today.
Welcome. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. I might add on to the comment.
If you could just note your name for the record, please.
Wayne Madlich, president of ITT Technical Institute in Portland and also president of Northwest Career Colleges Federation. Just a side note to the mention of Intel earlier. As most career colleges do, ITT has partnerships with businesses throughout the community. We concentrate on a few areas of high demand, electronics, as Linda is in, and IT. Recently, Intel has partnered with ITT to come on campus and hire directly. They were on our campus just last week. We actually had 13 ITT students hired directly into their local organization. We had 5 the week before, so that's 18 new employed people out of ITT and the Career College. We also extend their reach, since ITT is a national organization. If they need resources and we don't have enough in Oregon, we can provide those resources to come in from Washington, Idaho, our schools there. Intel is one of a few good stories. We have academic advisory councils in every area of study, where we have to have 5 to 12 professional organizations as part of our planning process, sort of a two-way sharing of what is happening in industry and where is education falling short on providing the resources, and what can we do in education to provide those resources. We're usually able to, we're a little bit more nimble. We could change to demands quicker and deliver those types of skills that the businesses need.
Questions for these witnesses? Could I just clarify, and Jeremy, you almost said it, but I just wanted to make sure they're on the record. Obviously, BCTI has been a perfect example of kind of a school, a non-degree, for-profit school gone wild. If BCTI were still around, as I read this bill, they would not qualify for it because they're a non-degree, they were a non-degree granting school. Am I right on that?
Chair Hunt, that is correct.
Yeah, thanks. Representative Holby.
Thank you. I was wondering if you can comment. I mean, Representative Clem, you know, brought us this this form that evidently the Student Assistance Commission already has available, being able to donate into a fund already. And so I'm and saying that this bill, this part of the bill, isn't really necessary. So I'm just kind of curious about
Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Holby. As I said, the opportunity grant now, the students are eligible for that. And I think you mentioned earlier that in your view, that fund was for those attending public institutions. That's not entirely correct, because students who attend private nonprofit institutions can access that fund. The only students that are not are the ones in the private for-profit. The reason that we would like to establish a fund this way, as opposed to what Representative Clem has suggested, is that we hope in the future, with career schools, with foundations, alumni associations putting money into this, and beginning in 2013, disbursements can be made to students who can, in these degree granting accredited programs, they can start receiving these need-based grants. And over time, we hope, if we do our job in convincing policymakers in the state that these are good programs and good for the 40-40-20 objectives of the state, that the state in the future may choose to pool public monies into that to make it larger. That is our hope in the future. There's no requirement that that happen, but we don't want to lose that opportunity. And so that's why we would set up this account in the way that we're suggesting through this legislation, as opposed to what Representative Clem has suggested.
Thank you.
Thank you, all three. Appreciate you being here. Good luck on your physics exam.
Thank you.
You're going to go easy on her, aren't you?
I'm the one that got her off today.
All right. Good job. I then would invite up Susan Deegan, Emma Calloway, and Steve Gaffori. And actually, while they're coming up, Anna, maybe if there is whatever statutory information we have in response to Representative Barnhart's earlier question, if you could address that.
Certainly. Upon review of the statute, it actually does not specify that monies in the account or a certain percentage of monies in the accounts be used for the administration of OSAC.
That answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you,
Great.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome, all three of you, to the Rules Committee.
Yep. I guess I go first. Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Hunt and Olson, Co-Vice Chairs Berger and Holby, and members of the Rules Committee. For the record, my name is Susan Deegan, and I'm the administrator of the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission in Eugene. I'm here today to testify on House Bill 3670. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you. You have my written testimony, so I will be brief, and I will not repeat the points that my former colleagues and my other colleagues will tell you. Let me just say that this agency, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, can definitely administer the new fund and the new program as proposed. We could probably also do it as Representative Clem proposes, so those are two options. There are simply a few technical corrections that we would like to recommend as part of this bill, and those are specifically in Section 6, Paragraph 1. That section defines an eligible school as one that has been approved to offer and confer degrees by the Office of Degree Authorization, and that has been certified by ODA as an Oregon-based for-profit institution. We recommend clarifying that ODA approves individual programs that are offered by private, nonprofit, and for-profit institutions in Oregon. They do not approve institutions. We also recommend clarifying that ODA does not certify schools as Oregon-based institutions. In fact, the term Oregon-based is defined in the administrative rules for the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. We also finally recommend clarifying that the students that are enrolled in these programs, they're approved by the Office of Degree Authorization. However, the Office of Degree Authorization currently administer the statute does not really make clear whether ODA has the authority to administer programs that are offered online. And as such, given the way that the current statute or the current bill is written, we would have to limit eligibility to the program to those students who are enrolled in programs that are taught in physical classrooms in Oregon. So thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today, and I look forward to answering any questions you may have.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello, Co-Chairs Hunt and Olson. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association, and I'm here to speak about some concerns we have on this particular bill. The conversation about career schools and the use of the Oregon Opportunity Grant with career schools is something that has come up multiple times in the House Higher Education Subcommittee. There's been lengthy debate about career schools in general, as Representative Clem talked about, but that's not the concern of the Oregon Student Association. What our concern is often the fact that there are 80% of those who qualify for the Oregon Opportunity Grant don't receive the fund, and that the Oregon Opportunity Grant in general is very stretched. We're concerned that there isn't enough of it, and that mixed with some of the concerns that were previously expressed about career colleges make us concerned that the use of public funds in this way shouldn't be discussed in terms of this bill and what funds are set up, but that we should be allowed a more lengthy conversation about the Oregon Opportunity Grant and its use. And without that more in-depth conversation, we feel like this bill doesn't address the details and the important relation between career schools and an opportunity grant that would need to exist. So we're very concerned that the Oregon Opportunity Grant is far stretched at this point, and that this bill, when I first discussed this bill with the co-chairs, it was my understanding that it was just for private funds. And now myself and other students in reading the bill are confused, especially around in Section 1, where it says, for the purpose of the Oregon Opportunity Grant awarded under ORS 348.26. So that has a particular requirement, and so far career schools are not allowed to receive the Oregon Opportunity Grant. But then it also says that if career schools were then, it's my reading in this, would then go through the Office of Degree Authorization, then there seems to be some mismatch about who would have access to the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And that conversation in itself deserves a lot of in-depth discussion. So that's one of our main concerns. And I guess just more clarity on that would be very helpful in order for the Oregon Student Association to understand the purpose of this bill. And we would also suggest that we do our due diligence in providing and finding private donors for career schools and work with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission in that route before we address the more difficult conversation about how public funds should be used and the Oregon Opportunity Grant itself. So those are our concerns, and thank you for allowing me to speak today, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thanks. Steve, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kufore. I'm here representing the University of Phoenix. I want to first start off by saying this bill would not affect my client as the bill is presently written. Nevertheless, my client's very strongly supportive of the bill. I think what we need to do is take a step back and say, who is the bill addressing? The bill is not addressing schools. The bill is addressing students. And what we're saying by this bill is that different students have different educational needs and different kinds of opportunities that they are able to take advantage of. They are all Oregon citizens. They're all Oregon taxpayers, and their families have paid taxes. It seems to me that what we want to be doing as an Oregon legislature is giving the most opportunities, widest variety of opportunities that fit the individual needs of students wherever they are going to go to school, regardless of where they're going to school, a for-profit or not-for-profit school. This is an interesting bill. I've been around this for a long time. I've represented the University of Phoenix for about 15, 16 years, I forget exactly. When I first started, I went to the Scholarship Commission, as it was then called, and was told that time that the Scholarship Commission was very strongly supportive of the concept of for-profit schools being allowed, students at for-profit schools being allowed to receive money. from the scholarships that they were given, now opportunity grants. But there wasn't enough money. Then a couple of years ago, you may recall, Governor Kulongowski decided that was going to be one of his priorities was to put a bunch more money into the scholarship. And he did. So I went to his staff and I said, all right, you've got a lot more money. Here's a scholarship commission that wants to use some of this money for students who have different educational needs. Can we have some of it? And he said, no, actually not, because this was a very delicate balance of all these different interests, and so come back later. So I kind of put that in the back of my mind, I'm sure, one of these days. I don't know if this is ever going to happen. If I were representing the Oregon Students Association, I probably would say, you know, the same thing she's saying, but we're a long ways away from getting any state money into the scholarship commission. What I think this does is set up a process so that if in the future we ever come out of this recovery and there is some money, and the governor, Kitzhaber, who said we want to get a lot more students into higher education, here's an opportunity to get them there. My school, for example, University of Phoenix, is a night school. There are a lot of our students are all working. They can't go to the University of Oregon. They can't go to Portland Community College. They can't go to Reed College. They have two choices. They can either drop out of their jobs and work, or they can go to the University of Phoenix at night. That's a tough row. It's very difficult to do. But we have a very high success rate with these students. They're very determined to succeed, and they do succeed. You heard about some of the problems nationally. There are some problems with a lot of the national schools. There are problems with some of the schools in Oregon. But not the ones that this bill addresses. And we have very high standards in the state of Oregon. We have a program that, as you heard earlier from Representative Clem, is nationally recognized for its oversight of schools. Alan Contreras has been the national leader in this organization, and our Office of Degree Authorization does a good job of keeping schools in good shape. So I think if we have the proper sideboards, which I think the bill has, and I hope it sometime down the line will be expanded to include schools that are not headquartered in the state of Oregon, like my own. But I hope that that day happens, that this bill is the first step in getting that. That's my testimony, Mr. Chair. Questions. Happy to answer questions.
Representative Holby.
Thank you. I just got one last question, I think, for Susan. I guess historically I'm looking at this, and for-profit schools were excluded, and I don't think I have a problem with the concept of the private for-profit institutions creating their funds to provide scholarships to go to their schools. But the idea that we would use state money down the road, I guess is for me fundamentally a question, because it seems like part of that opportunity grant that's given to the student to help pay to go to school, part of the money will end up in the profit of the for-profit institution. And so I guess that's the fundamental issue that I'm, you know, struggling with. I have a hard time saying, here's money to go to school, and part of the money we're giving you is going to end up in a profit model. Can you comment about that, I guess, fundamental piece of the historically of how this statute's been set up and how it's been operated?
Co-Chair Hunt and Representative Holby, the way the statute currently exists, it limits the grant to students at public institutions, public degree granting, 2 and 4 year institutions, and 4 year private nonprofit institutions. So this bill would essentially change the existing statute. The question about whether students who attend for-profit institutions ought to be eligible for state money to attend for-profit institutions, that's been around since, I found a white paper from a former colleague who actually is now a member of our Board of Commissioners. It was a paper that was written in the 1970s, and it also discussed the same issue. Some states include for-profit institutions as part of their state need grant program. Other states do not, and the spectrum is extremely broad. So that's a difficult question to answer.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I think it's a false dichotomy here. If you look at the way public money is spent presently in education, public money buys textbooks. The textbooks are produced by for-profit textbook publishing companies. if a school building is built, public money is used to hire private contractors who pay money to for-profit companies to build the schools. We have a history of public and private jointly entering into the field of education for the public good, and I think that's what we have here. I think the bottom line is that the money is going to the students, and if you have students who are able to get an education that meets their needs, that is not available in the public sector, then what we're doing by denying them is really saying you're denied, although you're a citizen of the state of Oregon and a taxpayer, you're denied some financial help because of the school you happen to choose. I think that's wrong.
Please.
Thank you, Representative Hunt and Representative Holby. Just to address the perspective from the students is that there are some of these institutions, career colleges, who receive 89% of their revenue from financial aid dollars. And so there is a very large spectrum about the type of revenue that comes in, and some and a lot of that is from financial aid dollars. And there's a concern from the student perspective that there's a much higher default rate with those students. And if that's true, then shouldn't we be spending more time trying to figure out how to help students get through school in a successful way and not default, and make sure that we're preserving state dollars for instead of state dollars eventually going into, you know, the hands of dividends and you know, and stock prices and things like that. And so that's where our concern comes from, is who does this revenue belong to? And we think it should belong to the state and continue to regenerate back into the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, appreciate all three of you being here. Anyone else here for 3670? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3670. And we've got three remaining bills. Let's just work them in order. Let's open a work session on House Bill 3656.
Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 3656. You had this on the 19th of May. It requires the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to cooperate with local, state, and federal agencies and private landowners in fish and wildlife management. It requires the Commission to work with local governments to mitigate adverse economic impacts when adding to the list of threatened or endangered species. We have a fiscal statement that says minimum fiscal impact and no revenue impact. No amendments that I know of.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, move House Bill 3656 to the House floor with due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Olson moves House Bill 3656 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Amy, please call the roll.
Representative Garrett?
Excuse.
Representative Holby?
Yes.
Representative Wingard?
Excused.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Excused.
Co-Chair
Olson?
Aye. Co-Chair Hunt? Aye. Motion carries. And last, Representative...
Actually, he was asking to do that.
Okay. Last, Representative Johnson to carry that one. Close the work session on House Bill 3656 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 22.
Mr. Chairman, Victoria Cox is here to staff that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 22 allows educational programs under the Youth Corrections Education Program and Juvenile Detention Education Programs to award high school diplomas and alternative certificates, implement an assessment system, administer a national assessment, participate in the Oregon Teacher Corps Program, and participate in other programs under Oregon Educational Act for the 21st century. Declares emergency effective July 1, 2011. We have a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact on the bill.
Yeah. Victoria, you don't sound good.
I feel a lot better than I sound. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is actually, we have Autumn Wilburn from ODE here to testify. If anyone else would like to testify, please feel free to come forward. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, for the record, my name is Autumn Wilburn. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Department of Education. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 22, which is brought to you by the Department of Education. First, I want to give you just a little bit of background. JDEP, Juvenile Detention Education Programs, serve youth that are detained for a crime and awaiting the determination of their placement, such as those in a county juvenile detention facility. YSEP, Youth Corrections Education Programs, serve those youth that are already incarcerated for a period of time, such as those at McLaren or Hillcrest. The intent of these educational programs is to assure that the youth in those programs have access to the same curriculum of their peers and instruction similar to what they would have received if they were still in their home school districts. The Department of Education contracts with school districts and ESDs to provide these educational services. There are 10 YSET programs and 14 JDEP programs throughout the state that are under contract with the department. So this bill, Senate Bill 22, it allows YSEP and JDEP to participate in things such as awarding diplomas and administering assessments. This bill also provides benefits to teachers at the YSEP and JDEP facilities that are available to their peers at other public schools across the state, such as the Oregon Teacher Corps Program, Student Loan Forgiveness Programs, and the Oregon Mentorship Program. The department believes that there will be an added incentive for these students to seek a diploma during their incarceration and perhaps encourage them to further their education or training once they get back out into the adult world. We also believe that teachers at these facilities deserve the same benefits that teachers at other public schools enjoy. This bill passed out of the Senate committee and off the Senate floor unanimously, so I'd urge your support here in the House, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you.
Welcome. Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Hunt, and I'm also from the Department of Education. I'm just here to answer questions.
And Cindy and I are not related.
We are not.
Any any questions for Cindy?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
I think you answered all questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Again, anyone else want to testify on this one? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 22, and we're good to go on this one, right? Open the work session on Senate Bill 22. Co-Chair Olson.
Thank you. Chair Hunt, I move Senate Bill 22 to the House floor with due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 22 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Amy, please call the roll.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Wiener.
Excuse.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Excuse.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson.
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt.
Aye. Motion carries, and we'll ask Representative Wiener to carry that one. Close the work session on Senate Bill 22 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 27.
Mr. Chairman, Victoria Churchill.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 27 requires education service districts to prepare annual audit of district books and accounts, authorize the Oregon Department of Education to withhold state school fund distributions from ESDs if auditing deficiencies are identified, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2011. There is no fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and no conflicts on this bill.
Outstanding. Please proceed.
Excellent. Cindy Hunt, Department of Education. Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee. Senate Bill 27 that's in front of you is in some regards a housekeeping bill, but it also imposes additional accountability measures on ESDs regarding the state school funds that they receive. Currently, under municipal audit law, both school districts and education service districts are required to prepare audits. However, under our education laws, only school districts are required to turn in those audits to the Department of Education. Currently, most ESDs do turn in their audits. Under the bill, it would require this practice. It would also allow the department, if ESDs did not turn in their audits, to be able to withhold state school fund dollars as we currently do for school districts. It would also allow us to withhold a portion of the state school fund dollars if an ESD, for example, for 2 years, consecutive years, did not address audit deficiencies that were identified in their audit. This bill also passed unanimously out of the Senate Education Committee and off the Senate floor. And with that, if there are any questions.
You're just here for backup on this one, right? Okay.
Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I think I heard this. Just wanted to make sure that you said that they're already required to contract for and to submit to audits.
Yeah.
And receive an audit report.
Yeah. Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. They're currently required under municipal audit law, which applies to education service districts, to do an annual audit.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you both. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 27 and open a work session on Senate Bill 27. Co-Chair Olson.
Chair Hunt, I move Senate Bill 27 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 27 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, Amy.
Representative
Winger. Excused.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative
Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Excused.
Representative
Colby?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Hunt? Aye. Motion carries, and we will ask Representative Gelser to carry that one. We do have colleagues. We do have a possible measure for committee introduction. Should we, how soon do you think it'll be here? Should we just stand at ease for a couple minutes? Okay.
And it has been posted on the S drive where you can look at it electronically. We are making copies right now. It is LC 4216.
It's actually, why don't you describe it and maybe that will be enough.
This is, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is LC 4216. It's related to solid waste. The Legislative Council summary says excludes woody biomass combusted as fuel from definition of solid waste. It excludes wood residue combusted as fuel from definition that applies to solid waste regulation.
So, colleagues, there are five of us here. Is that enough of a description to warrant your votes to introduce as a committee measure?
I'm a yes.
Well familiar with this bill.
Hard yes.
Is there going to be any objection on this?
Mr. Chair, just for the record, my practice has always been to agree to introduce committee bills as a courtesy, and it doesn't mean, of course, that I support the bill, but simply...
Well, Mr. Chair, I will not do it unless Representative Berger is here to clarify that I am not bound to support it in the future.
Right. I think I just did that, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. because I did notice that Representative Berger was had momentarily stepped out.
Those are revenue co-chairs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett's right, though. You are not Representative Berger.
That is correct. Mr. Chair, may I note that I'm very, very aware of that.
So I think we're good for a motion on this, Mr. Co-Chair. Do I need to open a work session to introduce committee measures? Co-Chair Olson.
Okay. Chair, I move that we adopt LC 4216, dated 5/24/11, as a committee bill.
Co-Chair Olson moves the introduction of LC 4216, dated May 24th, 2011, as a committee measure. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
And, Mr. Chairman, we can get copies around to your offices
yes.
as quickly as possible. Here, they're coming in the door right now.
Perfect. Right on cue. Great. So, colleagues, we are not scheduled to meet again until Wednesday of next week. Right now, are we scheduled for both Wednesday and Thursday?
We are.
So Wednesday and Thursday of next week, I think still at 3 p.m. next week. And then moving, you should see on your calendars, beginning every day the following week, time blocked out from, I believe, 2:30 to 4.
2:30 to 4 every day.
So that will not be beginning next week, but begin beginning the following week. So we're not here on Memorial Day, so we will see you next Wednesday. Committee is adjourned.
Thank you very much.